This is a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Today I signed legislation and an executive order to hold China accountable for its oppressive actions against the people of Hong Kong. The Hong Kong Autonomy Act, which I signed this afternoon, passed unanimously through Congress. This law gives my administration powerful new tools to hold responsible the individuals and the entities involved in extinguishing Hong Kong's freedom. We've all watched what happened. Not a good situation. Their freedom's been taken away, their rights have been taken away, and with it goes Hong Kong, in my opinion, because it will no longer be able to compete with free markets. A lot of people will be leaving Hong Kong, I suspect.
We're still here, and this is the US-China Trade War Podcast. I am Finbar Birmingham on the political economy desk here at the South China Morning Post. Coming at you this week from a remote studio in Tin Hau, we've got a third wave of coronavirus in Hong Kong, and we are working from home again. It's Wednesday, July 15th. We awoke to the news that Donald Trump had signed the Hong Kong Autonomy Act as well as an executive order, the sum of which means that Hong Kong will be stripped of its special trading status in the eyes of the US government. We will unpack what this means in the grand scheme of things with John Carter and Joe Shin, our political economy editors here at the SCMP. And in the second half of the show, I'll be joined on the line by Stuart Lau. Stuart is our Europe correspondent. He's usually based in Brussels, but this week he's in London. He's in the right place at the right time, because it was announced yesterday that the British government is going to kick Huawei off its 5G network by 2027. Meanwhile, the European Union is losing patience with China with regard to bilateral negotiation over an investment treaty. Harsh words are being exchanged on all sides. You've got the Hong Kong issue, you've got Huawei, you've got trade. They say it never rains, but it pours, and it is positively lashing down. On with the show. Joined from our respective studios in exile by Joe Shin and John Carter, our political economy editors. Thanks for joining, guys. A big day for us here in Hong Kong. We woke up to the news that Donald Trump had signed an executive order as well as the Hong Kong Autonomy Act, the sum of which is going to see Hong Kong lose its special trading status. John, you talked us through this last week about what the possible eventualities are. What sort of what's the immediate impact here on Hong Kong today?
Well, the immediate impact is that Hong Kong people won't get visas to go to the U.S. As you have pointed out, the big issue was an action last week where the U.S. took away the ability of U.S. exporters to get exemptions for sending sensitive equipment to Hong Kong. So now those exports of high-tech equipment that could potentially be used for military purposes need a special license or approval from the U.S. government. And this is the big impact. The act today doesn't do very much on the trade front or on the economy front yet. We expect the other shoe to drop at some point, although Hong Kong exports very little directly to the U.S., so it's not going to have much of an economic impact.
That's tariffs, John, you mean. I was just saying, so it's tariffs that may apply to Hong Kong companies, but the deal also contains a clear pathway to sanctioning some Hong Kong officials and Chinese.
Well, this is what the Hong Kong Autonomy Act does, is it sanctions, requires the State Department to identify certain officials and individuals and organizations that have helped promulgate the Hong Kong national security law and sanction those people, which means they couldn't travel to the United States, and theoretically their assets, if held in the United States, could be seized. In addition, after a year, any bank that does business with these sanctioned people could be sanctioned itself. And so we understand a lot of banks are going through a very rigorous auditing process to determine who banks with them and whether these people represent potential risks to their business.
Yeah. We saw a very swift rebuke from Beijing, Zhou Xin, very stern statement promising retaliation in response to Trump signing the Hong Kong Autonomy Act. What do you think are the options for China? There's not really an equivalent of Hong Kong in the United States. So what do you reckon Beijing might do on this front?
Well, exactly, Finbar. Although this is being expected, you know, Trump will sign this Hong Kong Autonomy Act. But when the day really came, you still feel like that we are witnessing an important moment of history. You know, Hong Kong is no longer free, at least for the United States. Hong Kong is no longer autonomous. It's no longer special for the United States. It's just another Chinese city. So, and for Beijing, of course, this is outrageous because, you know, Hong Kong, factually, it still has an independent legal system. Factually, it still has a separate financial system. It still has its own currency. And of course, internet is still free. Although there's a national security law, the censorship of the Great Firewall hasn't arrived in Hong Kong, not yet. So Beijing is quite angry with this gesture or this signature by Trump, saying Hong Kong is no longer regarded as autonomous or special. And this was seen in Beijing more likely part of this whole confrontation initiated by Washington against China. So China has to respond very angry. But as you said, you know, the options are quite actually limited. Yesterday, China announced that it sanctioned Lockheed Martin, you know, who's selling the arms to Taiwan. But you know, it's, the choices are quite limited for Beijing because what it can do. I mean, it can kick out Tesla, it can kick out Apple, but this will hurt China more than to hurt the United States, I guess. So it's not on, apparently not on the cards. But yes, so we see from today going on forward, I think we can see more and more confrontations between Beijing and Washington. More disputes and, you know, less goodwill. So it's quite a worrying picture, broadly speaking.
This is only going in one direction, we can clearly see. This is a excerpt from President Trump's address on in the Rose Garden to the press, and we'll just play it for you briefly.
And we're going to do a lot more business because of it, because we just lost one competitor. It's the way it is. We lost a very, very serious competitor, that we incentivized to take a lot of business and do well. And we gave them a lot of business by doing what we did. We gave them things that nobody else had the right to do. And that gave them a big edge over other markets. And because of that edge, they've done really historic business, tremendous business, far bigger than anybody would have thought years ago when we did this gift. It was really a gift to freedom. Today, I also signed an executive order ending U.S. preferential treatment for Hong Kong. Hong Kong will now be treated the same as mainland China. No special privileges, no special economic treatment, and no export of sensitive technologies.
John Carter, Joe Shin, we've just heard President Trump describe Hong Kong as a serious competitor to the United States and that saying that this Autonomy Act will help to redress this. Guys, do you get a sense that Trump doesn't really know what he's talking about here? I mean, Hong Kong is not seriously considered a competitor of America.
Well, yes. Just looking at Hong Kong by itself, it's not a competitor to the United States in any way, shape, or form. What it is a proxy for the disputes between China and the United States. And so, because Hong Kong is the financial channel through which much of investment from the outside world into China flows through, hurting Hong Kong in the hardline Trump view will hurt China. And so that is what's going on here. It is not that Hong Kong is the competitor. It's China is the competitor, and we're going to hurt China through Hong Kong.
Joseon, do you want to come in on that?
Basically, I agree with John. I mean, Hong Kong has played such an important role for Chinese economy. You know, although we look at Hong Kong GDP now, say, oh, its GDP is smaller than Shanghai or Shenzhen, but it's Hong Kong's role is always special and can't be replaced by any other mainland Chinese city. I mean, from the history, you know, when Chairman Mao defeated the Kuomintang Army in 1949, and People's Liberation Army has arrived at the border of Hong Kong, and then the Chinese Premier, the most wise man in China, possibly saying, you know, we should keep Hong Kong as it is. You know, it will help China more than we just took it to become another Chinese city. So, you know, it happened because, like, in the 1950s, when China having the Korean War against the United States, when China was under sanctions, Hong Kong played a very important role shipping the key materials needed by China, by the new China. And, you know, in the 1970s and 80s, when Deng Xiaoping started to try market trials in Shenzhen, you know, it is the Hong Kong people bringing the first, you know, bringing the money, bringing the technology there, thus started China's economic takeoff. So when we're looking back of the history, it really feels like if, you know, the U.S. treat Hong Kong as another normal Chinese city, it seems China will take a heavy loss, economic loss, from this decision.
Sure. And I just want to touch on a few statistics. We had the American Chamber of Commerce release a very telling survey this week. Trump has said in his statement there that this is going to help U.S. businesses, but the survey that the AmCham released suggests that maybe not, although the survey was more about the national security law than the Hong Kong Autonomy Act, but of course the two are linked. 40.98% of US businesses in Hong Kong are very concerned about the national security law. 68.31% say they're more concerned than they were a month ago because they've actually seen what's in it. 48% say it will have a negative impact on business. You know, take into account that given a lot of people say they don't know as well, this is the majority of firms in terms of the actual result. And, you know, this tells us, guys, that this is not just, you know, that this is something that people are very concerned about, more concerned than they were a month ago.
Sure. And the uncertainty is what's really bothering business. Business likes certainty so that they can plan, so that they can invest, because an investment often takes years to produce a return. And so you need some certainty about the outlook. And what you have now with the new law is significant uncertainty, not only with how China will implement the law, or Hong Kong will implement the law, but also how the U.S. and other countries in the world will react to China imposing the law on Hong Kong, which creates a significant amount of political risk for any business doing business in Hong Kong.
Absolutely. One thing that we will touch on, by the time this podcast comes out, we will have seen the economic growth statistics for China's second quarter. Judging by everything we've seen over the past month, it looks like we're going to see a return to growth. Trade was way up, surprisingly. Purchasing manager indices have been good. Joe Xin, it looks as though after a dismal first quarter, the Chinese government will be able to trumpet this as a economic success.
Oh, yes. China is desperate for some good economic news. And I think for the data, it's just above 2% or 3%. But think about when we're looking at these data, we also have to be use a little bit of grain of salt, because this is achieved, you know, at the cost of, say, halting China's debt cut campaign. The leverage ratio in the economy has been increasing in the first quarter. And certainly China has somehow going to the old playbook of, you know, stimulating economic growth with state-led spending instead of consumer growth. And you know, looking at the Chinese economy, you can still see like consumption is weak, and export is still uncertainty, and there are lots of unemployment pressure. So the structural issues still remain. For instance, I mean, some sectors may be doing much better than the others, but for cinemas or for tourism, they are still in trouble. So when we look at these tomorrow's figures, although some people joke that it will be first time ever since 1840 that the Chinese economy will be top the world again, but we have to be with a little bit grain of salt in it.
Yeah, caveats required left, right, and center. John, would you go along with that?
Absolutely. The problem is it is the pandemic. It is, as we all know, has gotten significantly worse in the United States, which is one of China's big trading partners. And there have been new outbreaks here in Hong Kong, which have caused the economy to the government to lock down the economy again. China has done a good job so far in reacting quickly to new outbreaks, and has kept them under control. But this is a continuing risk. And the economic resurgence is from a very low level, so you have to be careful. And you need to wonder about the level of of unemployment in the economy and how long the factors that have pushed growth up in recent months, whether they'll continue given the downward pressures from abroad. We'll see.
That's excellent. John Carter, Zhou Xin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the US-China Trade War podcast, of course. However, it's worth noting that in other parts of the world, people are equally as angry with China over how it has behaved in terms of trade and business, the European Union being one such place. Trump has stolen the headlines with his tariffs, but all the while, the European Union has been quietly assembling a trade defense mechanism that could be even stronger than the US. We're waiting to see what might happen with a bilateral investment treaty negotiation, but it doesn't look great at this point. We caught up with Stuart to find out what's going on that side of the world. Delighted to be joined on the line by Stuart Lau, who is our Europe correspondent here at the South China Morning Post. He finds himself in London this week, and he is in the right place at the right time, because we have just had the decision from the United Kingdom government which will remove Huawei from its 5G network by 2027. Stuart, thanks for joining us today. We're keen to get a bit more insight on this, because the thought of having, you know, you're going to remove Huawei from the network is all well and good, but by 2027 feels like a long way away. What's the calculus there on the British government's part?
Good to talk to you here, Finbar. So apparently, according to the UK government, it's a very prudent and a very realistic timeline from their perspective. So Oliver Dowden, when he was the culture minister addressing the parliament yesterday, rolling out this Huawei ban phase by phase. So his argumentation was that we need time to remove part of the all the equipment that already existed in the network. And they also need to make sure that there wouldn't be any negative consequence to the reliability of the network in Britain. But as you rightly mentioned, of course, the timeline has drawn a lot of attention from the China hawks among the different MPs in the parliament. A lot of the Tory rebels, so to say, asking the government to sort of bring forward the timeline, the deadline, to exclude Huawei equipment by as early as 2025, which would be the end of the current government, and that's the time when the next election will take place. So a lot of pushback from the parliament about this 2027 deadline, but so far it doesn't seem like the government is going to move it any forward.
Yeah. Interesting about the sort of hardliners in the Tory party there. I mean, we all hear a lot about these China hawks in the United States. They're very prominent. They get a lot of column inches. We don't hear so much, I guess, these days, or we haven't yet, about the China hawks in the British government. Is this something that's been building for a while, Stuart?
I think they have been building for a while, and it started with people who were interested in the ongoing developments in Hong Kong. And particularly in the last half year when the coronavirus started, the outbreak, I would say there was a stronger and stronger element of this sort of China skepticism in British politics, most prominently among the Conservatives. And of course, you know, everything has been built up right now with the national security law in Hong Kong, with the BNO passport treatment from the British government. And that sort of emboldened the China hawks in the British politics. And so this just so happens that the Huawei decision has also been made, of course, with the British government referring to the US sanctions put in place with any companies dealing with Huawei, thereby weakening the possibility of Huawei securing safe and secure equipment for British networks. But of course, there's a very strong link between what the British government has been doing and the China hawks and the more hardline approach being adopted in the parliament.
What I want to ask you next, Stuart, is the UK has left the European Union. They are going to be looking for trade deals with everybody. I think that's fair to say. What, do you get a sense that they've calculated that this China, this anti-China backlash is worth more to them than the trading relationship, or is there a delicate balance that they're trying to strike?
The funny thing is, I've been asking the same question ever since the Brexit referendum. So I've been talking to, you know, British diplomats in China to get a sense, you know, how much attention there was actually in terms of Westminster reaching out to Zhongnanhai, if you like, to try to get a trade deal in the long run. The thing is, I think for now, the UK is, of course, pretty much focused on the future arrangements with the EU itself, and, of course, a trade deal with the US. I also see a lot of, under this conservative government especially, there's a lot of correlation between trade and values, like they would be talking about building trade blocks with Australia, with New Zealand, but also with Japan, you know, what they call the like-minded partners. So my reading is that inside the Foreign Office in London, there's a certain level of interest in having a trade deal with Beijing, but that's absolutely not the top of the priority right now.
Absolutely. And moving from London to Brussels, where there's another treaty and negotiation underway, the European Union and China, the clock is ticking, Stuart, towards what is seen by many as a tipping point for the EU-China investment treaty. Angela Merkel will be leaving office this year, seen as a real proponent of the deal. And at the same time, the mood towards China is souring in the continent as well. Do you get a sense from your discussions in Brussels that this treaty is likely to happen?
Just one little point. Angela Merkel will be stepping down next year. And so a lot of attention about who's going to succeed her, of course. And it's absolutely right that she's been playing a pivotal role in trying to draw the EU as close with China as possible in terms of trade. And it's also true that the clock is ticking, December 31st being the self-imposed deadline for this EU-China investment agreement. The sense in the EU is still relatively pessimistic, especially because so much political attention is being paid on coronavirus, the recovery fund. And of course, everyone is also watching what's going to happen in November in terms of the US presidential election. So in Brussels, there's a lot of talk, you know, whether this sort of transatlantic alliance could be revived in case of a Biden victory, and what that means for EU's own relations with China. And so I think everything is, you know, everyone is having a wait and see approach right now. So there's not a lot of optimism in terms of China agreeing to, you know, concessions like for the state-owned enterprises, which the EU has been pressing really hard for, or creating a more level playing field. I think those are the real concerns for the EU right now. And after 7 years in trade talks with China, I think, especially looking at the recent announcements made by the Chinese government in terms of further strengthening the state-owned enterprises, I would say European politicians and European, you know, trade policymakers, they are not very optimistic about an agreement by the end of this year. What happens next, we still need to see whether there's a Trump victory or Biden victory. That also plays a very key role here.
Yeah. The United States obviously hogs the headlines when it comes to action on China. They've been very sharp and very swift with how they've moved in terms of the tariffs. But I know that the European Union has also been building an arsenal of trade defence mechanisms, which I think it's fair to say are ready to go. I mean, everybody gets the sense that the US is hard on China, but the European Union is a force to be reckoned with as well. If this investment treaty doesn't work out, Stuart, according to plan, do you get a sense that the trading pattern will change, that there will be more trade defence unleashed by European Union officials?
That's right. I mean, they've already proposed a white paper which will target state subsidies from companies investing in the European Union single market. And so a lot of attention from the media was, of course, paid to the Chinese companies' activities in Europe and the state-owned enterprises, for example, but also different layers of Chinese companies that actually receive state funding from the Chinese government. And so the logic of the European Union, the European Commission in this case, is that there should be a level playing field between foreign enterprises and European enterprises within the single market in Europe. And so if Europe actually has rules forbidding state subsidies for European companies, why shouldn't the same apply to foreign companies? I mean, of course, it's not just for Chinese companies, but also Middle Eastern companies, Saudi companies, for example, but also Russian companies, which also have a very big presence of state subsidies in the European context. And so it's definitely right that Europe is also trying to strengthen itself But at the same time, they also don't want to focus the attention solely on Chinese enterprises, because they still, at the end of the day, want to have the investment agreement with China, because they believe this would be the best way for European companies to have a permanent presence in China, to have permanent business interests in China. Whether that's going to happen, we still need to see, while at the same time, Europe is also trying to do as much as it can to show to China that Europe wouldn't just sit idly and do nothing about Chinese enterprises and the state subsidies in Europe.
Yeah, sure. It's keeping you busy. I sometimes feel like you've cloned yourself. You're doing a lot. How do you find keeping on top of all of this work?
Well, I mean, for the last few months, of course, everything has become quite different with the coronavirus, and the lockdown is perhaps a little bit tougher than in Hong Kong. And so there's no physical press conference, for example. You see Carrie Lam facing journalists. That's nothing like this in Brussels or anywhere in Europe right now. Everything is done on Zoom, and you need to sit in front of the computer for 2 hours sometimes, you know, before some officials would appear and start talking to the press conference. So a bit of a change of modus operandi here. But by and large, I think, you know, there is so much interest in what China is doing, what's happening in Hong Kong. So it's definitely a busy time trying to explain to, you know, everyone in Europe about what's actually going on.
Great stuff. Well, Stuart, keep up the good work, and thanks for coming on the show. We'll talk to you soon.
Good to talk to you, Finpa. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this week's US-China Trade War podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham, here at the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong. Keep up to date with all the news on the Hong Kong Autonomy Act, on the trade war, on the European Investment Treaty at SEMP.com. You can follow us at SEMP Economy on Twitter. I'm at F Birmingham. That's Birmingham, B-E-R, not like the city. We'll be back same place next time. Wash your hands, keep your distance, and stay safe.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.